You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
As we enter the second half of the year, the third quarter, would you believe it? Where has the time gone? No, it's a good time to look back. And the JSE had its best quarter in almost 19 years, supported by rand hedges and stimulus measures taken by major central banks to ease the effects of COVID-19. We saw the local bourse gaining 22% in the second quarter. That's its best level since the last 3 months of 2001. Heavyweights Naspers and Prosus doing a lot of the heavy lifting, gaining around 24 and 29% respectively, and partly thanks to that stake in Chinese internet giant Tencent. Gold miners, the Tearaway again climbing almost 68%, and Richemont up 13.2%. Now, globally, market sentiment has been aided by the easing of monetary policy by the US Fed and the European Central Bank. We've also seen the rand strengthening more than 3% in the past 3 months. But today, the MSCI World Shares Index was down 0.2% after rising 18% over the last quarter. It still closed the first half around 8% lower from where it started the year. And after their best quarter since March of 2015, we saw European stocks turning negative today. And we also started the third quarter in terrible shape, down almost 1%. Wayne McCurry, portfolio manager at F&B Wealth and Investments, and Arena Fisser, director and ETF strategist and financial advisor at ETFSA, have your view from the market. Narina, kick us off. It certainly feels like we're beginning the new quarter, but it doesn't look very different from where we left off from the last one.
Good evening, Michael, and good evening to all the listeners as well. Yes, you know, as I was listening to your introduction, I thought, what an amazing thing base effects are. You know, it's so easy to look at the second quarter numbers and say, wow, what a spectacular quarter we had. But when you saw moves like we did during the first quarter, where so many of our assets lost between 50 and 40%, it's useful to remind ourselves that when something goes down by 50%, it actually has to double. In other words, go up by 100% just to get us back to the level where we started. And I think much of what we've seen during the second quarter, therefore, looks great on an absolute basis. You know, things up 30, 40%. But in many instances, like, for example, in our own equity market, we're not even back to where we started the year or where we were sort of mid-February prior to all of this happening. Yes, there are certainly some assets and some sectors of both the local market as well as many of the global markets that have recovered better. But it is interesting to see that this was not quite as broad-based maybe as one might like to think. You know, if I think of the US markets, for example, very much led by the tech rally. If you exclude the big tech stocks from some of those large indices, then suddenly the rest of the market actually did not look all that spectacular, or certainly not what the overall numbers would lead us to believe the performance was during the second quarter.
Absolutely. One quarter does certainly not make a summer, Wayne McCurry. And if you look at a year ago on the JSE Aussie, we're still down 6.3% from a year ago exactly. Year to date, we're down 4.8%. So that 22% gain in the quarter needs some perspective. The momentum, though, is it riding into the rest of the year, or are we now hitting something of a stumbling block as we await the outcome of potential second waves around the world and their impact on economic growth?
Yes, look, when you consider the stock market basically flat for the year, and our market's been flat since Ramaphosa, I mean, our market's just been flat for a number of years now. However, what we must understand when we look at the equity returns, South Africa and globally, we are still experiencing the worst, the quickest and the worst economic slump ever. I mean, literally in recorded history. This is the quickest the world has actually gone into a recession, and it's also the deepest recession we've had in multiple decades. And of course, recovery will happen and it will be quick, but stock markets, when you look at the absolute level of stock markets, there's no discounting what's happening in the real economy at the moment, and that still causes me some concern. And second wave and all of these things are an added risk, although I think worldwide, politicians, people have learned that you didn't know what lockdown was. You had no concept of lockdown, and there was no alternative other than to do lockdown, first of all. But when you evaluate the economic pain, the economic devastation that it's caused, I think it would be socially and politically extremely difficult to go to what we know as level 5, a full lockdown again because of the second wave, because people know the pain that it's caused first time around and would be a little bit more cautious second time around. But clearly the risk is still there.
Clearly the risk is still there. And Narina, on that issue, it's one thing to lock an economy down. It's quite another to back it out of a lockdown. But another thing entirely still to rebuild confidence. And even if you look at what happened in Sweden, they didn't go into lockdown, but consumer confidence followed very similar trajectories to countries that did go into some kind of lockdown. And I mention that because Yoko came out yesterday with their impact of COVID-19 on small businesses. They do a small business recovery monitor through their pay points that they have with merchants. And going into level 3 has really had little impact on SME turnover. It's still at 55% of pre-COVID levels. So opening the economy is one thing. I think rebuilding confidence quite another.
Absolutely. You know, one of my favorite sayings that I heard about this is that we went into this lockdown with a sledgehammer, but we need to come out of it with a scalpel. That's how finely this needs to be tuned. And the confidence aspect that you mentioned, I think, is absolutely vital. What we are definitely seeing evidence of is that even though regulations might allow people to now go back to the office, go back to school, resume some level of normality and activity, activity levels are just not picking up to the extent that the economy really needs it to pick up. And I think that's testimony to that lack of confidence. And I think maybe also the acknowledgement that the impact of this potentially, and I'm now specifically talking about the health impact, might be a lot more severe than we would have liked to see. So I think what is so much more important here is the behavioral changes that are required rather than the regulatory changes. I fully agree with Wayne. It was certainly required at the outset that this was a hard enforced regulatory lockdown. But coming out of it, I think the focus should be much more on ensuring that the necessary behavior changes take place. And that starts with me and you, each one of us individually. And from that level, we can build this out and build the confidence in terms of resuming normal economic activity. But until such time, I think, you know, the idea of sort of a swoosh shape to recovery in terms of economic activity, I think looks much more feasible for me than what we've seen in some of the numbers that looks at the outset like a V, but actually we know that the real economic numbers don't actually show that we're going to recover back to previous levels anytime soon. Some of the sort of whisper numbers that you hear now in some industries that it might take up to 2025 before we sort of regain the levels of economic activity that we saw prior to this lockdown. And I think what we will find also is that between industries, there's going to be significant differences in terms of how quickly and how strongly they come out of this and what is the lasting damage, what is the sort of the post-pandemic level at which economic activity and value add settles.
Very important, because there will inevitably be winners and losers. And you can look at the retailers and say, probably those that offer a lot more value as consumers trade down being the winners. You can say those in tech certainly being winners, those in hospitality and tourism, who knows when they'll recover. Wayne, I want to move on to the Fed minutes now, and they certainly revealed that a full recovery is unlikely. Stimulus will now be targeted, plus the surging infections that we see in the US, plus we see increasing US election and geopolitical uncertainty into the second half. Added into that, you can throw in elevated multiples and then central bank liquidity. What's going to cause this equation to break?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, because central bank liquidity just seems to be swamping every issue, swamping the economic devastation, swamping President Trump's re-election and all the geopolitical tension that will bring, because he's going to come out swinging. He's going to try every trick in the book to make sure he gets re-elected. It doesn't matter what the cost is to anyone or the world's economy or the people of America or the world at large. It doesn't actually matter. He's only got one thing, and that is to be re-elected. But this liquidity seems to be swamping every single negative that there is. And to be honest, even though I think the stock market can come back a little bit, not much, it can fall maybe 10% or maybe 15% for no real reason whatsoever, but there's no inflation in the world. So ultimately, if there is a cost to all of this free liquidity, it's going to probably be rising inflation. Cannot see this in the medium term. So the answer is, I suppose, liquidity beats everything.
Liquidity, if you play rock, paper, liquidity wins every single time. That's the trump card. Narina, another thing that this has ushered in, and I was chatting to Professor Brian Cantor about this earlier today on Business Day TV, is it's a perfect storm or perfect condition, shall I say, for capital raises. Interest rates at record lows, the fact that you've got companies wanting to shore up their balance sheets, and really what they've got to do is just ensure that the cost of that capital raised is paid off over the next couple of years. And considering where we are in the cycle, that does seem to be a pretty safe bet. How should investors be thinking about this flood of capital raising that we're seeing in the market?
You know, certainly it might sound at the outset like this is a great time to be doing it. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's still about where does the supplier of capital and those that require capital actually meet one another. So I think the pricing of some of these rights issues and capital raising exercises is also going to be very interesting. And what is the purpose of that capital raising? Is it really to maybe improve a dodgy-looking balance sheet? Is this about taking account of opportunities that might have been created by the pandemic? Is this really just trying to get your cash flow to some sort of positive level, or does it actually build on the future earnings capacity of that company? So I think one would have to be quite specific about the rights issues. What is it for? How is it going to pan out in terms of that company's future? It's not just that simple exercise of just saying, let's just rush to market and just go and get these. Again, it also depends on which industry you're in, what the confidence level in that industry is all about. You know, if we look at our own market, for example, and going back to maybe where we started the conversation in terms of the performance year to date, the financial sector is still down close on 30% year to date, whereas the resources sector is in positive territory. You know, so when you look also at the pricing of these rights issues, if you're in the financial sector, this is not the best time to maybe doing a capital raising when your share price is still relatively depressed from where it was. So I don't think it's just a case of one size fits all when it comes to these capital raising exercises.
Yeah, speaking of the financial sector, looking at that table of changes at quarter end, financials had, back to your point, Narina, pretty good quarter, up 9.4%. Year to date, down just over 34%, and exactly 12 months ago, down 37.6%. 2 years ago, down 38.9%. So it really pays to take a longer view on many of these issues. Wayne, there was an interesting note out from JP Morgan dealing with Sasol's write-down issues, and having a look at what else is going on in the energy space. Shell writing off $22 billion off. And BP as well, massive write-downs, as well as Chevron. So it does look likely that we'll see significant write-downs now from Sasol.
Yes. Look, we understand the book right now. The money's already spent. So what it boils down to is you have an asset that produces income and you place a value on that income. Now, for all the oil companies, they were using an estimate $60 a barrel for oil. Now you're going to use $45 a barrel, so you've got to write down your assets. So it is an accounting entry. I mean, it does change the net asset value of the share. It changes the gearing ratios and all of these things. So there are implications, but by and large, it's in the Sasol share price. If Sasol could take, $100 billion, big.
I just lost you for a second there. Narina, everyone's got an opinion on Sasol. I'm trying to look at where it ended off on the day, just as my screen freezes in front of me. Would you be nibbling away at Sasol at these levels at around about 130 Rand, I think was the last place that I saw it. I've seen some target prices of around 160. And if the economic data, which has been surprising on the positive side globally, continues to trend that way, surely demand for oil starts picking up and you start to see some more support for the oil price, which should be supportive for Sasol.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of ships that need to align here for this to pan out, as you've just sort of illustrated it. And I think I want to almost turn your question into not just about a view specifically on Sasol, but maybe any stock-specific sort of view at this stage. This is theoretically a market in which active management, in which stock picking really comes into its own, because there are such stark winners and losers between within industries and between industries and between countries and so on. This really is an opportunity to be able to do really good stock picking and active management. The problem is that you are highly dependent on good quality data. And I think that's where the problem comes in, is that the line of sight that we have in terms of the fundamentals, the drivers of return for many of these companies, are just so opaque at this stage. And that makes it incredibly difficult to really make forecasts with good confidence in terms of what the outlook for a particular company, country, industry, whatever it might be. And this is, I think, really just a long answer to your question around Sasol. No, and it's not a reflection that I won't be looking at Sasol at these levels, because I've got problems with Sasol in particular. For me, generally speaking, there was just such a high variability in the outlook for the fundamental drivers of many of these companies that I think it makes it incredibly difficult to make investment decisions with a high level of certainty under the current conditions.
For example, Wayne, spare a thought for potato farmers at the moment. Who would have thought it? Potato prices in the US are down over 70% year to date, and farmers are being forced to dump tons of potatoes into the market because almost all of the crop goes to the food service industry. And we know what's happened to that industry thanks to COVID.
So clearly people don't eat as many chips at home as what they did when they go to restaurants and buy chips. So yeah, that's one of the few things. Look, even when the industry opened up in total, quick service restaurants and sit down and restaurants, even when it's open in total, people are still cautious. And until there's a vaccine where people feel safe, will they start going out to the same extent? So the tourism industry, the entertainment industry, sporting industry, all of these industries, even when there's no regulation whatsoever, it's still going to be cautious. People are going to be very cautious until the vaccine comes out where people actually feel safe. So they're going to have a very, very tough time. And, I mean, we've seen, what is the quick service restaurant in the UK, is that all the stations, upper crust, that's right, upper crust, and even though there's no regulation and people can trade now, they're retrenching, you know, 10,000 people.
Yeah.
People are just cautious to go out of their houses now.
That's it. That's the next pandemic. Our next pandemic is a pandemic of unemployment. Wayne McCurry, Portfolio Manager at F&B Wealth and Investments, and Irina Fisser, Director, ETF Strategist and Financial Advisor at ETFSA.